Notes of the Denver gamblers laid away to mature, the move back to Salt Lake coming up, his mind frayed and undone, he turned naturally and immediately back to whiskey. It would give him something to do. It would bring in a little cash.
"By hell, it would make me laugh if it didn't make me want to kill him," Bruce said to his mother. "What if we get raided in Salt Lake? That would be a fine help to getting you well, wouldn't it? Why couldn't he wait till you got back on your feet, at least?"
"He'd just sit around and stew himself to death if he didn't have something to keep him busy," she said. "I don't care. He's better off doing something, even that." She was thinner. A week had made her thinner, and her cheeks looked sunken. But her eyes were still a sudden and incredible blue, unmisted by sickness. "You're not going to be too comfortable going across in the Ford, either," he said. "You might have thought of that." She shook her head and smiled.
"Don't worry about me. You help us get moved, and then you go back to school and be the head of the class."
"Head of the class," Bruce said. "I've been head of the class quite a lot, haven't I?"
"You have," she said, and the pride in her voice made him crawl. "You've got a good head. You can be an important man if you try, Bruce."
"Will you promise to come and live at the White House?" he said. With a fury that was close to tears, he went back to his half-finished packing. There were only two possibilities that he would go back to school this fall. One was that she would die before school opened. The other was that he would deliberately leave her to die with only the old man for company. He would have cut his throat before he would have agreed to either. They were packed for 2 days, waiting, before they had word from Beau. He wired from Salt Lake that he had taken an apartment and that they should come on. In the afternoon a truck came and got their freight. The next morning at 6, with the woods all around them showing the first fall color, and the lake a sheet of pure emerald, and the eastern sky so pure and blue it hurt the eyes, they started down the Big Rock Candy Mountain for home, for Salt Lake City, for the spot where the dead was buried and the living would die, and there was for Bruce none of the exhilaration that had blown him westward in June, though he was now, more truly than then, going home.
Part 9. Chapter 1. All through September she lay dying in the dark little apartment, in the bedroom through whose open windows in the morning Bruce could smell the bitter tang of the winter pall of smoke, coming down now, settling in the evenings, and lasting until the valley breeze cleared it out about noon. Through those windows, when he came in at 6 or 7 o'clock to find his mother wide awake, awake for no one knew how many hours, maybe all night, he could see the thin morning sun touching the back lawn of the apartment house opposite, and the yellowing leaves of the hickories along the sidewalk, like sunlight cut into long ovals. But no sun touched the bedroom. It was gloomy even at midday, and more than once Bruce felt like kicking the windows out of their frames, tearing down curtains, pushing the wall out to let one sweep of sun and light cleanse the room. The very air in the place was the color of patience and pain. The old man might at least, he thought, have found her a pleasant room to die in. He told her so, obliquely. "A pleasant room to be sick in," he put it. But she smiled at him from the bed, trying to braid her long hair with fingers that tired after a few motions.
"It's a nice enough room," she said. "It could be more cheerful. But then your dad never did have much of an eye for what made a house pleasant."
"No," Bruce said. "Here, let me do that." He took the rope of hair from her and braided it, found a rubber band for the end of each braid, and lifted her while he smoothed out sheets and pillow.
"Now, what for breakfast?" he said. "How about some ham and eggs this morning?"
Her smile was like the smile of a very old, very wise, very gentle grandmother.
"Maybe some orange juice," she said.
"Nothing else?"
"I'm not hungry, really."
Seeing how thin she had grown, he said miserably,
"You need to eat to get your strength back."
And he saw in her eyes, the bright, incredibly blue eyes, unmarked and clear, that she was smiling inside herself at the idea of getting her strength back.
If she pretended not to know that she was going to die, she did it to spare him, not herself.
"No milk?" he said. "Some milk toast, maybe."
"No, thanks. Just some orange juice. Don't go to any trouble."
"I'll bring you in an orange, and you can peel it yourself," he said.
He took the tray from the bed table and went into the kitchen.
Orange juice, when she had hardly eaten anything for 10 days.
He squeezed a big glass of orange juice, poured a glass of milk just in case it might tempt her, opened the icebox door and got out some grape juice for the same reason, scooped a dish of bright jello. The icebox was full of invalid's dishes that he had made and never got her to eat. He ought to give it up, he thought, lifting the tray. He ought to quit urging her to eat, let the weariness take her, shorten it for her. But how could he? She didn't want it that way. She wouldn't deliberately shorten her agony 1 second.
"Play it out till the whistle blows," he said bitterly, and hardened his mouth at that football-field stupidity that was here somehow present in his mother, and that he could neither fight against nor condemn.
60-0 against you, and the other team with a first down on your 5-yard line. But play it out. Break your neck on that last tackle in the end zone. That was the way she had done it all her life, and there was no changing her. His father was in the sick room when he came back, standing near the door, looking big and uneasy and out of place, his lips forming the platitudes that were all he could ever say to her now.
"How are you feeling this morning? Having any pains?"
And stooping to look out the window.
"Nice day again outside."
He moved aside when Bruce came with the tray. His eyes were bloodshot and wandering.
"There you are," Bruce said. "Let's see you clean that tray."
She laughed.
"My goodness, I can't eat all that."
Beau Mason wagged his head, and Bruce hated him for his fumbling bulk, his stupid, vague embarrassment.
"You want to eat," he said, and catching Bruce's eye, he almost flushed.
"At least he feels it," Bruce said. "At least he feels frozen out. Nobody wants him around, and he knows it. And by God, he's earned it."
"Well," the old man said, and looked out the window again. "Going to be a nice day."
He moved toward the door.
"Anything you want from town?"
"Are you going down already?" she said. "You haven't had breakfast yet."
"I can get something downtown." "There's plenty of stuff here," Bruce said. "I'll fix something in a minute."
Nothing to do, he thought. No place to go. But he has to rush out of here before breakfast just so he can hang around cigar stores and hotel lobbies all day. He watched his mother sip her orange juice.
"Come on," he said. "Let's get out of here and let Mom eat in peace."
He went into the kitchen and started breakfast. He was just putting the toast in the toaster when he heard his mother in the bedroom and ran in. Leaning back against the pillow, wiping her lips, she gave him a weak, apologetic smile.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I couldn't keep it down."
"Feel all right now?"
She nodded, and he took the pail into the bathroom. Not even her orange juice this morning. Worse and worse.
"Pa," he said when he came back, "I think we ought to get a nurse for Mom, till she gets back on her feet."
"You're better than any nurse," his mother said, "unless you get tired of taking care of me."
She wiped her lips, puckered her eyes at him.
"You're stuck in this apartment too much," she said. "But I don't need a nurse. I guess I can still do a few things for myself."
"And tire yourself all out," Bruce said. "I don't know how to take care of you, right?"
"You take care of me beautifully," she said. "A nurse would be expensive, too."
"Only $6 a day.
$6 a day,
his father said. He seemed suddenly angry. The indecision and helplessness dissolved in violence.
"My God, doesn't that show you? The minute anybody gets sick, there's 10 million vultures waiting to pounce. What makes a nurse worth $6 a day?
"See," Elsa said, "it's out of the question. Now why don't both of you go out and get some fresh air? You don't want to stick around with me all day."
"Yeah," Bruce said. "What if you got a pain?"
"I guess I could stand it. Maybe you could pull the telephone close, and if I need anything, I could call Mrs. Welch."
"What does she know about giving hypos?"
He looked at his father, and it was with difficulty that he kept his voice down.
"If you were sick yourself, you'd think a nurse was worth $6 a day," he said.
His father threw up his hands and walked to the door. $15 a shot for x-rays," he said. "The doctor coming here 3 or 4 times a week at $5 a throw. Medicine to buy, syringes to buy. God almighty, we're not made of money. We have to eat, too, you know. I'll play nurse myself if we need a nurse."
"You'd be a lot of good," Bruce said between his teeth. "Please," Elsa said. "I don't need a nurse, Bruce. Really, we're getting along just fine."
The old man came over to the bed, stooped to kiss her. His face was sober and tired, and his eyes redder than ever. "Don't think I don't want you to have the best care," he said. "It's just so damn quiet now, all outgo and no income. How'd it be if I got some good woman who could cook and clean and do things for you?"
"No," she said. "I'm an awful expense. I'm sorry."
He stared at her with whipped, bewildered eyes, rolled his shoulders, winced. "I've got a damn boil coming on my back," he said. "Every time I move, it half kills me."
"Oh, dear," she said.
Her instant sympathy, the spectacle of her lying there in the bed she would die in, crucified by unbearable pain every few hours, and wasting sympathy on a great booby's boil, made Bruce so furious he couldn't stay in the room. When his mother called him to fetch iodine and a bandage, he brought them sullenly, looking sideways at his father's milk-white body stripped to the waist, the angry red swelling between his shoulder blades, and his mother propped on one weak arm, all her attention and strength focused on painting and dressing the boil. He couldn't stand it. He escaped again. "Boils," he said. "Wouldn't it be just like him to have boils, the dirtiest, messiest kind of affliction he could get, and then come running to let his half-dead wife waste her strength babying him? Oh, my God," he said, "if he was only the one on that bed and she the one on her feet." And he knew that that, too, was wrong. It would have been obscene to see him have to bear the things she bore. When his father came out, shouldering himself gingerly into his coat, Bruce went out into the hall with him and confronted him there. "Mom just simply has to have a nurse," he said. "I can't do the things to make her comfortable that a nurse could." His father sighed. "If you can tell me how we can afford $6 more a day..."
"Go in debt," Bruce said. "She's dying in there. Can't you get that through your head?"
His father's eyes were glassy. He looked dazed, as if he had not slept for a long time. The outburst of irritability a few minutes ago had gone completely. "None of it can save her," he said. "That's just it. Do you think if she had a chance I wouldn't do everything, spend every cent we've got?" "All right," Bruce said. "She's dying, so let's let her die. I'll cut out the orange juice. That'll save 50 cents a day." For an instant, watching his father's hand clench, he thought they were going to have a fight there in the hall. He stood up to it, so furious himself that his stomach was a sick fluttering. Then the dark face of the old man twitched, his hands loosened, and without a word, he turned and went out.
"You mustn't be too hard on your dad," his mother said later. "He never was any good in sickness, his own or anybody else's."
"No," Bruce said. "Witness his boils."
"Boils are painful," she said. "There's hardly anything worse than a boil."
"You're having a little pain yourself," he said. "Why should you have to tend that big baby? What does he do for you when a pain hits you except stand around looking helpless?"
"He wants to help," she said. "He just can't stand to see anybody in pain, that's all. It drives him frantic. I remember when I scalded my arm, he was 10 times more scared than I was. He almost cried."
"If he wants to help so bad," Bruce said, "why won't he let me get a nurse? If he's so broke he can't afford a nurse for a couple of weeks, he ought to apply for charity." He went to the window and tried to make the shade roll higher to let in a little more light.
"Broke," he said. "He's rolling in money, $20,000 or $30,000, and he can't even—"
He turned on her. "You're going to have a nurse, whether he'll pay for her or not."
"Bruce," she said strongly. "I won't let you spend your money for a nurse. It's silly. I don't need one."
He made a bitter mouth at her. "Do you think you wouldn't have one now if I had any money? I haven't got $10 to my name." He went out to wash the dishes and clean up the house, and when he came back, she was in pain. She didn't want a hypo. It wasn't bad yet. But he gave her one anyway. "The object of a hypo," he said, "is to keep you from having any pain at all. You'll make a dope head of me. I guess we can take that chance."
A few minutes after the hypo, she dropped off into a heavy sleep. And when she awoke an hour or so after noon, he got her to drink a little grape juice. She wasn't hungry enough to take more. For a while, he read to her. He had filled a shelf with books from the library, but they were law books, history, things she wouldn't have liked or understood. So he started again on South Wind, which he had half finished, and she lay quietly like a dutiful child being read to. When he came to Miss Wilberforce, his mother giggled. He lowered the book to his lap. "Like it?" he said, pleased.
"It's good," she said. "That Miss Wilberforce reminds me of Edna Harkness. You remember Edna?"
"Sure. I didn't know she was a drunkard, though."
"Edna was lonesome," she said. "She used to sit alone, drinking, until she couldn't stand it, and then she'd come over to our house to cry. She tried to commit suicide there once."
"What for?"
"She was in love with somebody. Not Slip. He was just a piece of saddle leather as far as she was concerned. But another man, a Catholic. He wouldn't marry her unless she turned Catholic, and if she turned Catholic, then she couldn't get a divorce from Slip. She used to take off her clothes, too, sometimes."
"In white mud?"
"It sounds funny, doesn't it? 3 or 4 times. She kept saying she wasn't ashamed of her shape. She was so dreadfully afraid of getting old and homely."
Smiling, she shook her head.
"Poor Edna."
Seeing the life he had known as a small boy now strangely refocused through his mother's eyes, remembering Edna Harkness as a somewhat sallow and sagging woman married to a Texas cowpuncher, Bruce felt for a moment the strangeness of that past, those almost 23 years that were behind him now, irrecoverable, but more real than many things that happened in the present. Edna Harkness, with troubles that were silly and self-begotten, coming to his mother for sympathy and consolation. They had always come that way. Every lost sheep they had ever known had fed on her. While he groped back in that past, watching his mother's face, he saw the sweat pop in tiny beads on her forehead and lip, as if it were something squeezed through porous cloth, and saw her lips, even in the midst of a wry smile for poor Edna, go white and stiff. The blue eyes looked straight upward. Bruce dropped the book and stood up.
"Pain?"
She nodded, still in the throes. Her legs moved slightly under the spread.
"How long?"
"It's been coming on for a little while."
"Why in God's name didn't you tell me?" he said.
"I didn't want to interrupt. I thought it might go away." She grunted, a startled sound as if someone had knocked the wind out of her, and rolled half on her side. Full of the anger and panic that came over him when he saw her stricken with the pain, he ran into the kitchen, flipped on a burner on the stove, dissolved a codeine tablet in a half teaspoon of water, and held it over the blaze. In a moment the water sizzled around the edges, the tablet dissolved brownly, the mixture bubbled. Then fit the syringe together, draw the cooled mixture into it, press out the air bubbles carefully, and hurry back to the bedroom, for your mother is in agony, and this little weapon will straighten her cramped body, put her to sleep for a while, stall off the pain until next time, until this evening, maybe. The first paroxysm had passed, and she lay on her back again.
"Arm or leg?" he said.
"Make it."
"Leg,"
she said, and stiffened. He tore back the covers, found an unpunctured spot above her knee, a clear patch on the blue punctured skin, swabbed with the wad of alcohol-soaked cotton, laid the needle against her skin, slanting, and jabbed. The codeine made a tiny bluish bump under the skin, and the needle hole wept one colorless tear as he swabbed again and covered her. Feeling better?
In a minute.
Her smile was so strained that he bent over her.
Why don't you cry?
He said. It'd be easier. She let out a shuddering breath, as if exhaling the pain with the air.
I guess I've forgotten how,
she said quite seriously.
I try sometimes. I can't.
For a few moments he stood over her watching. The tightness went gradually out of her face, the forehead smoothed out.
Want to take a little sleep? He said.
She nodded, and he opened the window, pulled the shades down, straightened the sheet under her chin, kissed her, and went out. In the other room he tried to read, but he couldn't concentrate. Once, reading through a discussion of riparian rights, his eyes distinctly saw in print the words, "Codeine at 9 o'clock, codeine again at 2, only 5 hours between pains now." Tiptoeing to the half-open door, he saw that his mother was asleep. On an impulse he slipped into the hall and up to the apartment of Mrs. Welch, the only person they knew in the building.
"I wonder if you could do me a favor," he said. "Are you going to be busy for the next hour or two?"
"No," she said.
"What is it?"
She was a fat, comfortable woman, too sympathetic and too continuously ready to weep. But she would do.
"Could you sit with Mother? She's asleep and ought to sleep a couple of hours. I have to go uptown for a few minutes."
"Why, sure," she said. She gathered up her magazine and came along, and Bruce put on his coat and went out into the air. Dr. Cullen sat at his desk, twirling a swab stick between his palms.
"Anything wrong at home?"
"There's nothing very much right."
"Mother worse?"
"Oh, I don't know," Bruce said. "About the same, I guess. Maybe she's worse. The codeine doesn't seem to have the effect it used to. She had to have a hypo at 9 and another one at 2.
"Yes," the doctor said. "We have to expect that."
He scribbled a prescription on the pad and tore it off, holding the sheet by the corners and blowing on it gently so that it rotated. His face was smooth and impassive, and his voice was the careful, flat, guarded voice Bruce remembered from the operating room.
"How is she eating?"
"Not at all. She can't even keep fruit juice down now."
Cullen said. He blew the prescription sheet.
"If you want to," he said, "we can feed her by bowel. It would mean prolonging her life a week, 2 weeks."
"Would it make her any stronger?" Bruce said. "Would it help her stay stronger right to the end, even if she has to be full of dope, so she won't just dwindle away?"
He felt his face twisting and forced himself to look straight at the doctor.
"It's that dwindling that's hard to watch," he said. "She gets smaller and thinner every day."
"Bowel feeding would help that," Cullen said. "You couldn't do it very well, though."
"That's what I came to see you about," Bruce said.
It was difficult to talk. The office was too padded, too quiet, the doctor's voice too carefully controlled. He knew Cullen liked and admired his mother, and that made it harder to talk to him.
"I spoke to the old man this morning about a nurse," he said.
"He says it's too expensive."
With fascinated helplessness, he heard himself shouting. "I can't stand to sit around there and watch her die cheaply," he said. "She's got to have a nurse. I'll mortgage any money I ever make."
"No," Cullen said. "I wouldn't want to see you do that." He looked out the window, and Bruce dabbed furiously at his wet eyes, crying, sitting here bawling like a baby.
"I know a woman," the doctor said, turning. "I'll send her over tonight. And don't worry about the bill. I'll have Miss Ostler pay it, and then add it to my bill. Your father can think I'm a hold-up man."
"Thanks,"
Bruce said. He took out his handkerchief and blew his nose.
"I'm sorry I blew up. I just get so..."
Cullen rose and laid the prescription in Bruce's hand.
"What are you going to do?"
he said. "Afterwards?"
"I don't know.
Go back to school, I suppose, if I can find any way to work it out."
"Coming back here to practice after you get your degree?"
"I hadn't thought much about it.
Don't, the doctor said.
What?
Bruce said. I'm a busybody, Cullen said. I'm giving you advice. I've known your family for a good many years, and I can't help knowing a few things. Give yourself a chance. Get away from all that history.
I suppose that's right, Bruce said.
I might as well say my piece out, Cullen said. Stop me if you want.
He paused, and Bruce made a little motion with his hand.
Your mother is an exceptional woman, Cullen said. I don't imagine she ever had any opportunities at all, but she's arrived at something without them. She's wise and brave and decent. But she's going to die, and there's nothing we can do for her except make her comfortable. When she does, clear out. And if there ever comes a time when your father wants to use you, live on you, get anything from you, keep out of it. He could spoil your life.
He laid his hand on Bruce's shoulder.
I'll drop by in the morning, he said as he went.
Bruce stayed in the room for 5 minutes with his back to the hallway, looking out the windows into the paved court. Even though you knew it, even though you were watching it every day, it came hard to hear the doctor say she would die. He remembered looking at the pictures of her lungs with the rentgenologist, the scientific finger pointing out the blurred and darkened places in the web of ribs and organs that was his mother.
She's doomed, the X-ray man said that day, and his big voice, too big for so small a man, boomed in the hollow office. He could hear it now.
The nurse and another patient came in.
Oh, I'm sorry, she said. I thought Dr. Cullen had finished with you.
He has, Bruce said. He brushed by her and went out. The coming of Miss Hammond, the nurse, changed the quality of living in the apartment. It gave to his mother's dying a dignity it had not had before, a professional neatness, an air of propriety and authority. Miss Hammond was a neat and efficient and tireless young woman. She took complete charge of the place, cooked the meals, made the beds, fed and bathed and changed her patient. She even, when Beau Mason came in the next morning to have Elsa dress his boil, took charge of that, too, in spite of his grumbling and distrust. From the moment she came in the door, Bruce knew he had an ally. Her first look around, with its covert criticism of the respectable gloom of the rooms and the immediacy with which his mother liked her, cheered him up. And when his father had gone out, he saw her fussing with the blinds in the bedroom, trying to coax them up, as he had, to let a little light and sun in. "It's no use," he said. "The place is like a dungeon. There's no help for it." She smiled a little as she looked at him, her lips curving slowly, a pleasant, cheerful face.
"Some flowers might help," she said.
Bruce looked from her to his mother and back.
"My God," he said.
She had lain in the gloom for 3 weeks, and he had never once thought to bring her flowers.
"Bruce has been stuck inside with me so much," his mother said. "He's hardly had a chance to poke his nose outside."
"Don't alibi me," he said. "I ought to be kicked." He looked at Miss Hammond and laughed. "I'll be back in an hour or two," he said. In 10 minutes he was on his way up Mill Creek Canyon. He had little money to buy flowers, and it would take $20 worth to brighten up that bedroom. But there were other things. Ahead of him the steep scarp of the Wasatch rose like a mighty wall, and on all the slopes, in every erosion gully, the oak brush lay like a tufted green bronze blanket. He could see the tufts, tender and soft as wool, clear on down past Olympus and Twin Peaks, on down to the long ramp of Long Peak, running down to the point at the Jordan Narrows. In one gash down the side of Long Peak, 10 miles away, lay a tongue of brilliant scarlet. Ahead of him, the sharp V of the canyon mouth opened, and in it, only an occasional tree at first, but higher up, more and more, the ripe maples bloomed, fiery as poinsettias. He parked the car on a side road on the flat above the Boy Scout camp and started up the rocky slope. High up, his arms full of branches of sumac and maple and yellow aspen,
He sat down and smoked a cigarette. West of him, the view opened, framed in the V of the canyon, the broad valley still green with truck gardens and alfalfa, the petty point of orchards, the broad yellow and white band of the salt marshes, and beyond that band the cobalt line of the lake, the tawny ochres on the south end, feathered with smoke from the smelters. At the right, just visible, was the end of Antelope Island, yellow-gold in the blue and white distance, and far beyond that, almost lost in the haze, the tracery of the barren ranges on the far side, almost 70 miles away. He picked a leaf from the sheaf of branches beside him and chewed the bitter stem, his eyes on that view. He had seen it dozens of times, from the top of Olympus, from the saddle of Twin, from the westward rim of the Wasatch at a dozen different points, but looking at it now, he narrowed his eyes and thought, as a man stopped by a noise in the heavy dusk of the woods might stop and peer in search of what had startled him. There was something lost and long forgotten stirring in the undergrowth of his memory, something far back as Saskatchewan. That sweep of flat land below the abrupt thrust of the mountains, the notched door through which he saw it. Then he had it, the bear paws, the picnic they had taken from the homestead when he was very young, the afternoon on the wooded shelf beside the spring, with the whole Montana plain under them. His mother had carried armfuls of leaves back with her from that picnic, in love with their cool feel and the memories they stirred in her of Minnesota. Maple leaves, pointed like a spread hand. And he himself, then as now, had been smothered by a memory, had been groping all afternoon to remember something from still another time in the mountains, when he was very young indeed, barely out of infancy. This haunting sense of familiarity, this dream within a dream. For a moment his brain whirled. Memory was a trap, a pit, a labyrinth. It tricked you into looking backward, and you saw yourself in another avatar, smaller and more narrow-visioned, but richer in the life of the senses. And in that incarnation, too, you were looking back. You met yourself in your past, and the recognition was a strong, quick shock like a dive into cold water. If you could pass that door, if you could look back through many funneling memories instead of one or two, you might be able to escape the incommunicable identity in which you lay hidden. You might remember your mother's memories, or your father's, contain within yourself the entire experience of your family, going back and back in time, a succession of diminishing images like the images in double mirrors, go back and beyond in time as the ranges went back and beyond in distance, past the cobalt line of the lake. He was not Bruce Mason, but a girl of 18 named Elsa Norgard, and he was sick in his mind to escape from the prison that home had become. And he was a boy named Harry Mason, running away from home at 14, the world wide ahead of him, and at his back a house full of hatred and bad treatment. He opened his eyes wide and breathed his lungs full and shook his head to clear it. He felt drunk, dizzy, but he thought he knew something that he hadn't known before. That was the way it went. The dog wolf killed its young. The young wolves turned on the strength which begot them. You hate your father, and I'll hate mine, in a circling, spiraling continuity up from the time-hazed past. You honor your mother, I'll honor mine. The varieties of family experience, he said, and thought of Proust, the sick man crawling backward among the obscenities of recollection, and of Samuel Butler, so cursed in his heritage that he would never marry and have children to dominate and tyrannize over. Sick and cursed, he said, as sick as Proust and as cursed as Butler. But he didn't exactly understand what he meant by it. And his mind shied away, wary after that tottering moment when memory had opened under him like a gulf, and the solidities of the known world, the comfortable assumptions of his own identity, had slipped out of reach
and left him poised on the brink of the unknowable. Carefully, his mind as cautious and deliberate as his feet, he started climbing down the rocky slope with the bundle of brilliant leaves in his arm. Chapter 2 October 1st was his mother's birthday. On that morning, because he had time now to go and come as he wanted, he went downtown and, with part of his few dollars, bought her a quilted satin bed jacket. She had visitors sometimes. She ought at least to look nice, as if she were being taken care of. When he gave it to her, she looked as if she were going to cry. She fumbled with the wrapping, and when she had it open, her fingers lay on the satin quietly.
"Bruce, you shouldn't have," she said. "I won't."
"Hush," he said. "You needed it. And I couldn't let your birthday go by. There's something important about birthdays."
"I guess I haven't forgotten how to cry after all," she said,
and squeezed his hand. At 11 she had a bad pain, and the hypo, morphine now instead of codeine, put her almost immediately to sleep. Miss Hammond went out for a walk, and Bruce read. When she came back, she said immediately,
"I've got a suggestion, if you won't think I'm butting in."
"No."
"What?" "I was just talking to the landlord. There's an apartment vacant on the other side, much lighter than this, with plenty of sun."
"Is it clean? Ready to move into?"
"It's just been all cleaned and redecorated."
"I'll go see about it," he said. "Will you help? If it's all right, could we do it alone?" He paused, looking at the bedroom door.
"How about moving her? If you carried her, it would be much pleasanter on the other side."
In 10 minutes he was back. The new apartment was $5 a month more, but he would let the old man worry about that.
"Come on," he said. "Let's get this done before she even wakes up."
At 5, his father wandered in, stood in the door of the stripped apartment, staring.
"What's going on?" he said.
Coming out of the kitchen with the last bags of condiments, odds and ends, spices, groceries, Bruce said, "We're moving downstairs and across the hall." He half expected his father to be enraged at the way all initiative had been taken from him, all decision in his own house. But the old man simply moved aside as he came through the door, stood a little, stooping with the pain of his boil, his face slack and tired.
"Sunnier down there?" he said.
"A lot." Bruce stopped with his arms full, willing, for just that minute, to let him back into her family.
"Did you remember Mom's birthday?"
"Birthday? Is it her birthday?"
"Today," Bruce said.
"I forgot, I guess," his father said.
"You could do something nice for her."
The quick, suspicious look stopped him. His father, for all his fumbling helplessness now, was no fool. He knew he was an outsider, but he wouldn't be pushed around and told what to do. Bruce started to go on, but his father stopped him.
"What?"
he said.
"It'd be nice if she had some flowers when she moved in. I'd have got some, only I didn't have any money."
His father's answer was so prompt and hearty that it surprised him.
"I'll get some," he said. "You got all the stuff down?"
"We'll be through in about 15 minutes.
As if his tiredness had left him suddenly, the old man went down the steps and outside. When he came back, he had his arms full of flowers, a great sheaf of gladioli, a bundle of bronze and yellow chrysanthemums, a potted geranium, and a big potted fern. He gave them up gingerly to Miss Hammond, walked all through the apartment, looking it over, stepped into the sleeping porch, glassed on 3 sides, with Venetian blinds for privacy, where the sick woman would be put.
"It's better, don't you think?"
Bruce said.
"Yes,"
the old man said.
"Is your mother asleep?"
"She was a few minutes ago. The hypo before lunch laid her out."
"Yeah," his father said.
His eyes were vague, wandering, looking anywhere but at Bruce, and his cheeks were thinner than Bruce ever remembered them. He looked sick himself.
"Have you noticed about her lately?"
he said.
"That dope is getting her. She's so far off all the time, as if she didn't know where she was."
"I haven't noticed it."
"No?"
His father jingled change in his pocket.
Well, he turned toward the door. We might as well bring her down. She was awake, but still dreamy and thick-tongued. Her face and throat were wet with perspiration, and the pillowcase under her head was soaked. As they entered, all three at once, she turned her head to smile, a smile in which sweetness and wry apology were mixed. She held one braid in her hand back on the pillow. Beau approached, tiptoeing, and the way he moved made Bruce mad. Why did he have to act as if she lay there with candles at head and feet and the death house hush already in the room? He stooped to kiss her, and she made a face. "I'm ashamed," she said. "I sweat so, and my hair gets so sour. I couldn't have a shampoo, could I, Miss Hammond?" "I'm afraid not," the nurse said. "I'll get a towel and dry it for you."
"I'll get you some perfume tomorrow," Beau said. "Make you smell like a flower garden."
He picked up the quilted jacket that lay on the foot of the bed.
"Where'd this come from?"
"Bruce gave it to me. Isn't it lovely?"
"Yeah."
His eyes wandered. Stymied again, Bruce thought. Too slow to think of her birthday himself, but resentful of having anyone else do it.
"You're having quite a birthday," he said. "Moving and everything."
"Moving?"
"Didn't you know?"
"No, moving where?"
The vague and wandering look on his face gave way to a look sly and sidelong. His eyes caught Bruce's.
"At least I'm in on this," they said. "Here's one thing you haven't shut me out of." "We've got a little surprise for you," he said,
and the "we" was a clear insistence on his right to have a place in his own family. But the sick woman's eyes, Bruce noticed, turned away from him, turned to Bruce himself for an explanation, and that was triumph of a sort. Miss Hammond came in with a bath towel, unbraided the damp hair, helped the sick woman to sit up, and began drying her hair, rubbing handfuls of it between folds of the towel until it stood out all around her head. It was like a light in the room, like the brilliant leaves, curling and dry now, that were still banked in a vase between the windows. Miss Hammond began smoothing the hair down with a brush, but when she took hold of it to rebraid it, Beau Mason said, quite unexpectedly,
"Leave it down a while. Let her look pretty for her birthday."
"Pretty," she said drowsily. "I'll bet I look pretty."
"You do," Bruce said. And now he was trying, just as his father had, to intrude on something that was between the other two. Her prettiness had been the old man's, not his. All his own memories of her were worn like an old tintype, the shadow of pain and resignation lying behind the calm face, so that many times he had had the impression that his mother's face was sad, though there was nothing tangible to base that impression on. Her mouth did not droop. Her eyes had light crow's feet of laughter at the corners. There were no bitter lines.
"You do look pretty," he said, in a kind of desperation, hating his father for seeing and saying it first. "You've got a glow on you."
"It's her hair," Miss Hammond said. "She's got lovely hair."
"It's because everybody is so nice to me," Elsa said. "If you baby me, I might cry."
Miss Hammond held the jacket for her to slip her arms into, tied the foolish pom-pom strings at the wrists.
"Doesn't she look pretty?" she said.
Elsa made another face, the color higher in her cheeks, as if they had caught a reflection from the gorgeous hair.
"Well," Beau said, "ready to move?"
"Where are we going?"
She looked at Miss Hammond with crinkling eyes.
"All my life he's been moving me around," she said. "I can't even get sick and stay quietly in bed. He has to move me within a month."
"You'll like this move," Beau said.
Again, Bruce felt a twinge of irritation at the way the old man butted in and took credit for something he would never have thought of for himself. Then he remembered that he hadn't thought of it either. Miss Hammond had thought of it. He lifted the dried leaves from the vase and stuck them, crackling, into the wastebasket.
"Bruce," his mother said, "my nice leaves."
"They're all dead. There's something better where you're going."
His eyes held his father's in ironic renunciation of his part in the birthday change. Let him have it. He couldn't hold it anyway. And at least he was being pleasant. He had had the inspiration, or the good luck, to call his wife pretty and bring a bloom on her. Let him have it, as long as she was pleased.
"How are we going to do this?" she said. "Is it far?"
"Just a step," Beau said. "I'll carry you."
"Carry me? I can walk?"
"In a pig's eye," he said. "Here." He bent over, and as the coat tightened across his broad back, he stopped as if paralyzed. A grunt of pain escaped him, and her eyes jumped to his face in alarm.
"What is it?"
"My goddamn boil," he said between his teeth. He straightened up carefully, moving his shoulders as if to tempt the pain into revealing its location. Bruce stepped forward. "You'd better not," he said. "I'll carry her." But his father blocked his way. "I'll take her," he said. "Keep your shirt on." He bent again, slowly.
"Bo," Elsa said, "do you think you'd better? There's no need to hurt yourself."
"I'll carry you," he said harshly. "Take hold of my neck."
She put her arms around his neck.
"I'm pretty heavy,"
she said anxiously. Bruce, watching, saw his father set his teeth and lift, saw the pain hit him and his mouth tighten. And he saw something else. The sick woman's body came up lightly, easily, and the old man staggered a little, as a man expecting another step in the dark staggers when his foot finds none. Bruce knew. He had lifted her in bed. She had wasted away to nothing. But he saw in the instant of his father's lifting that the old man hadn't known, that he was surprised and shocked. His right arm was under her knees, and her white feet trailed out from the nightdress. Her arms were around his neck, her hair falling down the back of his coat.
"Okay," the old man said grimly. "Here we go."
He shot one look at Bruce, a look with pain and triumph and horror in it, and stepped out through the door, swinging her feet carefully to avoid bumping them. Miss Hammond darted ahead to make the bed ready. Bruce followed behind.
"Hurting you?" Beau said.
"No," she said. "How about you?"
He stepped carefully down the stairs. Over his shoulder, Elsa's face twitched with something that might have been pain, and Bruce smiled at her with stiff lips.
"Just like a bride over the threshold," he said.
That was what he had been planning to say as he himself carried her into the new apartment. He hated the sight of his father's broad back with her hair shawled across it. In the new living room, she exclaimed aloud. The sun, just setting, came full through the west window, flushing the perfect gladioli against the curtains.
"Oh," she said, "the sunny side!"
Steadily, without pausing, Beau carried her into the glassed porch, and Bruce saw her hand come down to brush the petals of the geranium as she was carried by it. Carefully, Beau laid her on the bed, and Miss Hammond drew the sheet up around her waist, leaving her shoulders propped high.
"There," Beau said. "How do you like it?"
Her eyes went over the neat room, the geranium, and the green delicacy of ferns against the Venetian blinds. Her fingers touched the crisp sheet at her waist, and the cry that was wrenched from her was like an accusation.
"I told you I'd cry," she said,
and put her hands over her face. Chapter 3 That night, Bruce sat reading a dull and blundering volume of history while his mother and father talked in the glassed porch. He heard their voices, and even more clearly the pauses in their talk. Miss Hammond sat under the other lamp stitching at one of her patient's nightgowns. Once she glanced up and said,
"What are you studying so hard?"
"History."
"What for? Going back to school?"
"Sometime, maybe." He saw her lower her head again, embarrassed at having come too close to the thing they all avoided. His eyes were on the white jamb of the door through which the voices of his father and mother came, low and intimate. What could they find to talk about so long? In a few minutes, his father came to the door of the sick room.
"I guess she wants to get to sleep," he said to Miss Hammond.
The nurse went in, came out after a while, and nodded to Bruce, and he went in and took his mother's hand. "Well," he said. She squeezed his hand and shook it lightly. Her hair was braided again for the night, and the shaded bed lamp threw shadows on her face so that it looked pinched and starved.
"It's been a lovely day," she said.
"I'm glad. You look better than you have for quite a while."
"I feel better," she said. "You must be tired from moving."
She lay for a while looking quietly past and beyond, at the wall or at nothing.
"Where's everyone going to sleep down here?" she said. "You've given me the nicest place, and Pa says there's only one other bedroom."
"He'll be in that. I'll sleep in the Murphy bed in the living room, and Miss Hammond's got a cot set up in the dining room."
"She can't be comfortable on a cot. Isn't there anything—"
"I tried to make her take the Murphy. She won't." Her hand held his, patted it, as if unwilling to give it up.
"Well, good night, then," she said.
"Good night."
He stooped to kiss her. Trust the old man to sit and talk and tire her out completely. She hardly had strength to turn over in bed, the old brainless fumbling.
"Sleep tight,"
he said, and left her. Miss Hammond closed the door all but a crack, so that the light would not bother her, and then the three sat in the living room, the old man with his hands on his knees, vacant and unoccupied, his body slumped in the chair. He looked old and dissipated and sick, his face dark with black bags under his eyes. Bruce watched him covertly, saw him put up a hand to rub his face, heard the rasp of bristles under the big square hand. "He looked like a man with a foot in the grave, and scarcely the strength of a louse." The lines jumped to his mind, and with them the memory, clear and sharp, of the family around the stove in the little parlor in White Mud, his mother darning, he and Chet hugging their knees on the floor to hear their father read Robert W. Service.
"Liking it," he said.
"Lapping it up, fascinated and impressed, loving him then, briefly, absorbing images and inflections and words that would never leave the mind, that would always be a part of his memory of the time when they had lived in one house for 5 years. It was incredible that at times in his childhood he had watched the dark face of his father with love and admiration and trust. His eyes went rubbering round the room, and he seemed in a sort of daze.
"She's gone," his father said.
Bruce lowered his book and looked up. His father's face was ghastly, and his mouth worked.
"You can see it just to look at her," he said. "She's so quiet. She's got no interest in anything."
Bruce said nothing, and Miss Hammond, after one quick look, dropped her head over her mending.
"All but her eyes," the old man said.
With a puzzled face, he looked directly at Bruce for the first time.
"You never know it by her eyes," he said. "They're just as bright and clear. You'd never know she'd been sick a day."
He rubbed his palm across his face again.
"What are you reading?"
Bruce held up the book.
"Studying, huh?" "Yeah."
The momentary interest flickered out.
"It's the dope," he said. "She's hopped up all the time. She can hardly make herself listen to what you're saying."
"Maybe she didn't want to," Bruce said. "She's weak. She hasn't got the strength to talk much." His father stood up. His trousers were bagged and wrinkled, and there were cigar ashes on his sleeve. He started to say something, closed his mouth, shot a look of quick, hard suspicion at Bruce, and wandered over to the dining room table, through the sliding doors. He swung around.
"How long?" he said.
Bruce shook his head. "I asked Cullen. He can't tell. He says if she didn't have a heart like a horse, she'd be gone now." The old man moistened his lips.
"Yeah," he said vaguely.
He stayed with his fingertips touching the table, turned again.
"Do you think I—"
He stopped, took his fingers off the wood, and went through the hall to his own bedroom, shutting the door behind him. Bruce drew a deep breath, looked once at Miss Hammond's troubled face, and opened the book again. He awoke late. Miss Hammond had his place set at the breakfast table, but the other dishes were all washed and put away. His father was not around. "My dad gone uptown already?" he said as he came in from the bathroom. "He's gone away," Miss Hammond said. She went to the cupboard and got out an envelope. "He left this and said he'd be gone 3 or 4 days."
"Well, what in hell?"
Bruce said. He opened the envelope. There were some bills in it. $40.
"Did he say where he was going?"
"No, I gathered it was business. He had to go," he said.
"Yeah,"
Bruce said, starting for the bedroom. "Is mother awake?"
"Yes,
she seems to know all about it." At the door of the porch, Bruce checked himself. He couldn't rush in there in a fury and demand an explanation. For a moment he stood gnawing his lip and glancing back at Miss Hammond, he saw with absolute clearness the nurse's complex of bewilderment and sympathy and desire to stay back out of family troubles. But even while he was looking at her, he forgot her. So the old man had skipped. He put his teeth together and went into the porch.
"Hi,"
he said. Her smiling face turned toward him, but in the first glance he knew that something had happened to her. She was worse. There was no brightness in her. He came up and laid his hand on her forehead, cool and moist as putty.
"How is it this morning?" he said. "I was a pig. I slept till 8:30.
"Good,"
she said, as if her mouth were almost too tired to form the word. Her smile was only a crinkling of the lines around her eyes.
"Miss Hammond says Pa's gone," he said, watching her, seeing in her face how close the end was now,
how she seemed to grope in a mist, make an effort to look out from somewhere, like a person looking backward from the moving observation car of a train. The wrinkles deepened around her eyes, that was all.
"He's been shut up too long," she said.
"I don't see," he began, but she stopped him.
"Don't blame him," she said. "He just wasn't made for it."
"He must have had an excuse," he said. "He's always got an excuse." His mother smiled.
"He went for a load. He had to be doing something."
"Did he tell you first?"
"He told me last night. Patton's got some stuff waiting for him in Los Angeles. He'll be back in a few days."
He said nothing more, but he saw in her face everything he needed to know. She wouldn't last those 3 days, and the old man had known it. She had said her goodbyes and sent him out, knowing she wouldn't live till his return, and she lay there now, ready at any time, living only by physiological habit. That was the change he had seen when he came in. There had been an air of resistance in her before. Something, the old man's cowardice, had broken the brightness and will in her.
"Shall I read to you?" he said.
"Yes, would you?"
Even while he read with an automatic voice, using only the top of his mind, the floor of his mind was uneasy with rage and contempt and wonder. To pull out, to run, to leave her when he knew she was dying, to go after a load of whiskey, worry himself into a 1,500-mile trip on the pretense that he was getting low on money, couldn't afford to stay off the job any longer. At his wife's funeral, he would probably take orders for cases of scotch. Oh, the goddamn contemptible, selfish, cowardly, heartless old bastard!
"Yes,"
his mother said. He looked up, confused, and realized that he had stopped reading.
"Sorry,"
he said, and picked up the story where he thought he must have broken off. Now for 2 days he watched and waited with sick and hopeless certainty, his mother farther and farther away, withdrawing deeper into herself and the numbing morphine. It was obscene and unjust the way she had to die,
Loving her as he did, he was offended a dozen times a day by the sour smell of her sweat in the sick room and the horror of the noises she made in breathing. It outraged him that she could not die sweetly and quietly with her family around her, wrapped in love and the sense of a life that had fruited and borne. Instead, she lay most of the time like a stranger,